You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeter. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Steeter.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Wednesday, July 2nd, 2014. My name is Sam Steeter. This is the three-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, Professor Juan Cole, Director of the Center for Middle Eastern and North African Studies at the University of Michigan, author of the new book, The New Arabs, How the Millennial Generation is Changing the Middle East. Also on the program, it's a new age in Georgia. Carry your gun anywhere, and you won't believe the hijinks. Also on the program today, highway construction will be down this summer. And that's not good news. Meanwhile, the ugliness of the anti-immigration movement rears its head in Murrieta, California. Also, what really is the matter with Kansas? And will Brownback get voted out for it? And the heartwarming story of conservatives perceiving the poor as having it easy. And, of course, today marks the 50th anniversary of the signing of the Civil Rights Act in an era when we can't even get a highway funding bill passed. So sue me, says the president. All that and more on today's program. Folks, you will notice that at the beginning of the show today, I did not say, in the literal and metaphorical shadow of the New York Times building, but instead of the New York Times. This has been something of controversy over the years, and a listener, Ed, writes, I don't think this makes sense in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building. If something is literal, then by definition it's not metaphorical. So anything you should be saying, the literal and not metaphorical, although that's a bit redundant. By using the word though, you're inferring there's a chance literal could also be metaphorical, which can't be. And you're seemingly making sure we understand it's not true in this case, but it will never be true. That is why I've dropped the word building.
Wow.
Because I am now referring to both the building and the institution itself, which then gets clarified by saying, though. Folks, this stuff doesn't happen on its own. That's why we need your support. Please become a member today at majority.fm. We rely on your memberships for all of our revenue. And
right. We had the best IM in the world yesterday.
All right. Well, we'll talk about that later. Just a reminder, no program on Friday. We are taking the day off totally to celebrate this nation's independence. Tomorrow on the show, we will be talking about not only about this Facebook experiment, but we will also run the Lawrence Lessig interview that we referred to yesterday in the Knappenberger interview about Aaron Swartz. So tomorrow will be jam-packed. We'll be back in just a moment with Professor Juan Cole. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome back to the program Professor Juan Cole. He's the director of the Center for Middle Eastern and North African Studies at the University of Michigan. Of course, you are all familiar with his blog, Informed Comment, at juancole.com. And he has a new book, The New Arabs, How the Millennial Generation is Changing the Middle East. Welcome to the program, Professor.
Thanks so much, Sam.
So I want to start, let's start, I guess, more short and midterm, and then we will move to the longer term in talking about your book. But just, I guess, yesterday, ISIS, this is the Islamic State in Iraq and the Levant, or in Syria, has proclaimed that the area, I guess, that they now occupy is a caliphate. What does that mean, and is that relevant at all?
Yeah, the early Islam was often ruled by caliphs who claimed to be vicars of the Prophet Muhammad. In a way, in Western Christianity, at sometimes the popes had held sway over territory, or you had the Holy Roman Emperor at one point. So it's a hearkening back to those medieval forms of governance. But, frankly, it's faintly ridiculous, and I think very few Muslims would take it seriously. The ISIS is a small terrorist group that's been known for its extreme brutality. So it's a little bit as though, the Grand Wizard of the Ku Klux Klan declared himself the Holy Roman Emperor. I don't think most people would take that very seriously.
And also today, my understanding is that there has been announced a referendum for Kurdish independence. Is there, do you have any information on that? I mean, it almost seems a little bit, there's not as much drama, I guess, associated with that in some respects, because this was sort of anticipated at this point.
Well, the drama around the Kurdish desire for independence had long been a very strong opposition to it on the part of the neighboring countries. Turkey, Syria, and Iran all have very significant Kurdish populations that are right next to the Kurds in northern Iraq, and there was a fear among the neighbors that if one Kurdish population declared a state, that it might, break up these other countries. So they were opposed to it. But at the moment, Syria is not really in a position to say much about anything, since it's riven with civil war and the government doesn't control half the country. And Turkey has had a change of heart, apparently. The northern Iraq, where the Kurds rule, what they call Kurdistan, is a place where enormous amounts of Turkish capital have been invested. 70% of the investment up there is from Turkey, and the Kurds have made oil deals with Ankara recently. And then the Kurds are a buffer for Turkey from all of the turmoil that's going on in Arab Iraq with the rise of extreme fundamentalism, both Shiite and Sunni. So for various reasons, it appears to be the case that the Turkish government's very vehement former objections to this development have fallen by the wayside, and they can now live with it. So that's probably what's enabling it to happen.
And so give me your sense of what is happening now in Iraq in regard to the ISIS's movements and attempts, obviously, to move towards Baghdad. We have announcements today that the U.S. is now sending helicopters as well as drones, following up on now what appears to be about 800 U.S. troops that have been sent or are going to be sent the remaining complement to Iraq. What is your sense as to what's happening politically in Iraq now?
My interpretation of what has happened in Iraq is that the Sunni Arab population of the country in the north and west are done out with the central government. And they're so upset with how they've been treated and with the lack of jobs, the lack of government services, lack of electricity, water shortages, and so forth, that they conspired across ideologies and across various boundaries to stage a series of uprisings against the government in cities like Mosul and Fallujah and Ramadi, among the more successful conspirators in this set of uprisings and one that lent a kind of framework to it all was the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria. So this was not, you know, a set of conquests. The ISIS didn't march down from Syria and take Mosul. It was the people of Mosul rose up, and they chased away the Iraqi army. They threw stones at it and threatened to, massive crowds threatened to just tear them to shreds. And so they ran away. The Iraqi army has been sectarianized. A lot of it is Shiite. They were in alien territory amongst the sea of Sunnis up there who were very unhappy with them. So because I think things have unfolded in this way, I'm fairly confident that ISIS can't do much in Baghdad because it has become a largely Shiite population. There are a lot of Shiite armed militias there. So I think if ISIS tried to do something in Baghdad of a political nature, they can blow things up. But of a political nature, the Shiites would just shred them.
And, you know, and we spoke about this, I guess, a couple of weeks ago now when I interviewed you on Ring of Fire. And I still think that this is sort of this dynamic is somewhat underreported. It seems to me that this is that ISIS was sort of the tip of the spear, as it were, and it really the state of Iraq now is that story that they simply enabled what was simmering, I guess, this the Sunni feelings of oppression and alienation. And so at what point does ISIS go too far for those Sunnis? I mean, are they now are they building an infrastructure in these territories essentially? And at one point, do they get strong enough where they say, "Okay, we no longer need ISIS, and it's time to also rid ourselves of ISIS"? I mean, how will this play out?
Well, Iraqi journalists, independent Iraqi journalists who write for a site that's underwritten by Germany called Niqash.org, it's Niqash, some of them have gone to ISIS-held cities like Hawija and Mosul in the north and have reported back on the situation there in the past week. And they do find those kinds of fissures that you have been discussing. Apparently, the Baathists, the secular nationalists in Mosul, feel as though ISIS overreached, that they had made a deal with it to ally against al-Maliki and throw off the government. But then in the aftermath, ISIS has been grabby and has tried to take control of Mosul. And the Baathists are not happy about this. And likewise, in Hawija, there are severe tensions between ISIS and the tribal leaders. It's a clan-based society there. And so it seems to me entirely possible that over time there will be, you know, power struggles. ISIS is a relatively small organization, and that it could hold all these cities in the long term seems unlikely. They are also known for their viciousness and brutality. So a lot of times their apparent power may just come from intimidating people. But intimidation is not a plausible method of governance in the long term.
And so in Baghdad, there is obviously, there seems to be, from a political standpoint, there seems to be a lot of talk about a new government forming. I mean, how likely is that? And then a subset of that question is just my saying Ahmed Shalabi with a question mark after it.
Yeah, I am puzzled by the talk about Ahmed Shalabi as a possible prime minister. I don't think he's in parliament. I'm not sure he's eligible to be prime minister. And if we get a new prime minister in Iraq through a parliamentary process, with parliament, it was supposed to meet on Tuesday. It was supposed to elect a speaker of parliament, and then it was supposed to elect a president. The president that would then appoint a prime minister from the parliamentarians who had the most seats, the most backers in parliament. So at the moment, that's Nouri al-Maliki. It's not impossible that others could put together a post-election coalition that's bigger than his. But if things unfold in the constitutional way and in a parliamentary way, then Chalabi just doesn't seem to me very plausible. The only way he could come to power, it seems to me, would be in some kind of coup.
And so is it unlikely at this point, I mean, from your perspective, that Maliki steps down or steps aside or is voted out? Or, is the fact that he's now that the Iraqi government has now sort of, I guess, agreed to some form of some type of status of forces agreement, so much so that the U.S. can bring 800 troops into Iraq, and as well as obviously supplying more helicopters and drones. I mean, is that an indication that there's some movement on him being more inclusive in terms of the Iraqi government and more, I guess, providing more consideration for Sunnis in the country?
Well, things are a mess, and it's very unclear. Al-Maliki on Wednesday announced that there would be an amnesty for those Sunnis who made an alliance of convenience with ISIS if they would now turn against it and rejoin the Baghdad political grouping. On Tuesday, when Parliament met, they had a recess, and then the Sunni and the Kurdish representatives declined to return, along with some of the Shiites, so that there was no quorum to proceed with the electing of the new officers of the state. So, and that seems to have been a protest against al-Maliki remaining as prime minister. So it may well be that al-Maliki just cannot muster the votes to remain. It's not clear who parliament would choose to replace him if there's somebody who is acceptable to the majority. With regard to the Americans, Sam, those troops that are being sent in by Obama are just to guard the embassy. Since the Iraqi army collapsed in the face of the Sunni uprising, I think confidence in it is at an all-time low in Washington, and it's supposed to be the one that's guarding the U.S. embassy. So after the Benghazi disaster and the political football that the Republican Party turned that into on the Hill, you can only imagine how petrified the National Security Council must be that ISIS fighters will infiltrate into the Green Zone and do something to the American diplomats there. And what the firestorm would be in the aftermath in the United States. So I think those troops are mainly being sent in to guard the embassy. Then there are some that are coordinating tactics and intelligence with what's left of the Iraqi army. The parliament has not granted them immunity, and they don't really need to because I don't think they're war fighters. But al-Maliki has kind of assured the administration that he won't move against them judicially.
Okay, let's turn to your book, which is being released. I think is it today?
It came out yesterday.
Oh, yesterday. And the New Arabs: How the Millennial Generation is Changing the Middle East. Who are the New Arabs?
Well, I'm talking about the Generation Y, or the Millennials, is what the demographers and marketers call them. The people born between the late 70s and the year 2000. And they're a very major cohort. They're over a third of the population of the Arab world, some 370 million Arabs in the world. So they're over nearly 40% of them. So it's an enormous youth bulge. The median age of the Arab world is only 24, which is half that of Germany or Japan. These young people strike me as being quite remarkable and very different from their parents, whom I knew. They're much more urban, much more literate, much more media savvy, hooked in with satellite television and the internet. Many of them have worked abroad, including in Europe. And they're across the board at least somewhat less religiously observant than their elders. So they are, you know, a distinctive cohort.
And so, I mean, what is it about them that they aspire, I guess, to, I mean, I don't know, democracy may be too crude of a word, but a more pluralistic, a more open society? Is it simply that they're just more sophisticated insofar as that they have more access to what, I guess, those a more pluralistic and open society would be about? I mean, what is it simply that they have access to it because of the technology, or what is it?
I think it is, in some important part, their access to satellite images and stories, and also the internet. Some European elections, the French election of last year between François Hollande and Nicolas Sarkozy, that, you know, is in a way a local event in a place like Tunisia, and people follow all those things. And so, you know, when I first went to the Arab world back in the 70s, Sam, you know, typically there was like one state television station, and their idea of news was long, loving shots of the dictator sitting on a Louis the 14th chair with a visiting dignitary and playing John Philip Sousa in the background. And this would go on for, you know, 10 minutes and with no commentary. So that was, you know, it was a kind of symbolic television broadcast rather than being actual news, and a celebration of the dictatorship. And these dictators, you know, became extremely corrupt. They put on almost royal airs, and then they started to imagine that they could pass on their presidencies for life to their eldest son. So there was, they were becoming, in a way, a kind of monarchy in the republics. And the young people just decided they weren't going to put up with this. They weren't going to be inherited as though they were sticks of furniture. And they didn't want presidents for life or republican monarchies. And they stopped it from happening. They got rid of four sitting presidents who had been long-time dictators, and they made a couple others very insecure. And then the sons are simply not going to inherit. It's not that most of the sons are on trial, and even in Egypt, which is newly authoritarian again, the new constitution limits the president to 2 4-year terms at most. So I think it's often not recognized that they really have changed the terms of the political game in the Arab world in very significant ways.
Yeah, I mean, you talk about their throwing over monarch publicanism or monarch public and this was one of the achievements of the Arab Spring that you contend has at least. I mean, I wonder if it's now obviously you can put in Egypt only two terms, and then at the end of those two terms, something often comes up. But I guess the idea is that there has been a change in this regard as to the psyche of the population in terms of what they expect and what they'll tolerate.
That's right. I really think it would be very difficult for the Egyptian constitution now to be changed. And General Abdel Fattah al-Sisi has taken off his uniform and become a civilian, and he's been elected president. But before he ran, I was in Egypt in March, and I heard him give a speech. And he forthrightly admitted, he said, you know, those days where the military junta can just decide who the next president is going to be in Egypt are over with. Everybody understands, he said, that no one can be president of Egypt unless the Egyptian people vote him into office. It's true that the election that he held was nothing to write home about. It probably isn't certifiable as to international standards, but he did have an opponent, and it wasn't just a referendum, and he did feel as though he had to resort to the ballot box. He couldn't just stay as a dictator by fiat, and he does seem at the moment to be fairly popular. So the discourse of politics just has changed all around from what it was in 2009, and the same things are true in Tunisia and Libya. The elected prime minister in Tunisia, who oversaw the writing of a new constitution, you know, it was demanded that he step down and that a government of technocrats be formed to oversee the coming election so that the incumbents don't, you know, put their thumb on the scale. There were massive demonstrations with this demand, and he ultimately did step down, even though he had been fairly elected, in favor of a technocratic government in order to meet this popular demand of the youth and the labor unions. So this is the first time in modern history that, you know, you've had a civilian government that voluntarily relinquished power, an elected civilian government. And then even in Libya, which is, of course, a security mess, there's been a kerfuffle over who the prime minister should be, and parliament voted somebody in, but there was a question as to whether he'd really gotten the sufficient number of votes. And it went to the Libyan Supreme Court, and they said, no, you know, he hadn't gotten enough votes to be prime minister. And he came out and gave a speech that, you know, the rule of law is really important, and so I'm bowing out since the Supreme Court ruled in this way. Well, I mean, you know, even though the Libyan government is very weak and it's not very important, maybe, nevertheless, for politicians to talk like this and to act like this, I can't tell you how different it is from just a few years ago when you had this mercurial Gaddafi clan in power and they did whatever they wanted to do.
I mean, it's fascinating. To a certain extent, the institutions have yet to catch up with this massive, I guess, cultural shift. I mean, I guess maybe that's the best way to describe it.
Yeah.
And I think your argument in your book is that eventually they will. But let's talk about another cultural difference that you suggest that the Arab Spring brought about, or, you know, maybe it's even better to say this was a milestone where I guess a critical mass was achieved, was the notion of a more multicultural vision of how society should work. in the context of the Arab world. Explain to us what that means and how that is a change as well.
Yes, well, the keynotes of politics in the 1950s and 60s were Arab nationalism, and this was a reaction in some large part to Western colonialism and imperialism in the region. So people were trying to recover their pride and their culture and their language and to some extent their religion. But this emphasis on Arabness was frequently done in a very chauvinist way, and the people who proposed it didn't take into account that there are fair numbers of ethnic minorities in the Arab world that don't think of themselves as Arab. You have the Kurds in Iraq, you have the Berbers or Amazigh people in many countries of North Africa. And in Gaddafi's Libya, for instance, the Amazigh language was just forbidden in public, and people couldn't celebrate their culture as Berbers. There were also, you know, forms of discrimination against the Amazigh in Morocco. And so ethnic forms of discrimination are not viewed positively on the whole in this younger generation. And so after the revolution against Gaddafi in Libya, the Amazigh have started having cultural festivals, and their language has been recognized as a legitimate Libyan language. And the young people, the bloggers and so forth, are celebrating this change. Also in Morocco, actually, it didn't have a revolution, but there were a lot of demonstrations in 2011, and the young king is rather savvy, and he had a new constitution fashioned to try to meet some of these protesters' demands, and that constitution gives official status to the Amazigh language in Morocco. And my Berber friends from Morocco are much happier with their situation now in the aftermath. So there's more ethnic multiculturalism and recognition of minority rights among the younger generation. Also, and with regard to religion, you know, most of these countries have a majority that's, except in Iraq, you know, is Sunni. Sunni Muslim in orientation, but Egypt has a significant Coptic Christian minority, between 5% and 10%. Syria has likewise probably 5% Christians, and Tunisia even has, you know, a small Jewish, and in Morocco as well have small Jewish communities. And the youth, again, they celebrate the rights of these religious minorities. I can't tell you how outraged my Tunisian young friends were when Salafis chanted against Jews. So I think there's a real sea change in these kinds of attitudes.
Yeah, it's fascinating. And let's turn to the youth that you focus on. And you know, your overall thesis is that in some ways it mirrors, I think, the way that we talk about Occupy, the Occupy movement in this country, that that people have dispersed into sort of other areas and are learning organizational traits and skill sets that, when they come of age, I guess, that they will then will see applied to government. I mean, you talk about that in the context of particularly in Egypt, of the disbursement of a lot of the people who were part of the youth, I guess, element of the movement. Because, you know, and I think we've spoken in the past that one of the key factors to what happened, at least in Egypt, was the youth reaching out to labor, essentially. And there were, I can't remember, 1,300 labor strikes in the years leading up to Tahrir Square. Talk about that as to where those leaders have gone, the youth leaders.
Well, it depends on the country. The youth leaders of these youth organizations, you know, they often have the word youth in their names, and they organize themselves for the promotion of the interests of their generation. They do tend to be liberal or left of center, and they in Tunisia, as I said, they reached out to labor unions and had a big impact on the political process again in summer and fall of 2013. And in Libya, there are enormous numbers of new non-governmental organizations. Charity work, promotion of literacy, water provision, all kinds of things they're involved in. And in fact, there's more of a demand for volunteers and workers in these than there is a supply. And the youth predominate in them. So if you walked into one of these NGOs' offices, you'd find 25-year-olds sitting there. And, you know, this is the kind of thing they can do, because in many of these countries, they're not old enough to stand for office. We forget, I think, sometimes how young they are. And people ask me, you know, why didn't they form political parties? And I think of them less like Occupy, although that's maybe, you know, there are some analogies there, but more like Greenpeace and those kinds of civil society organizations that promote particular causes and which are organized as networks rather than as political parties, but which have an impact on public policy. And that's the kind of thing that these young people continue to be involved in. Unfortunately, in Egypt, the turn to authoritarianism has been such that some of the more prominent activists of the past decade are now in prison. The military-backed government passed a draconian anti-protest law that you can't protest unless you get permission from the Minister of Interior, and the youth say that the government doesn't seem to understand the concept of protest. So they've defied that law, and some of them have been sentenced to as many as 3 years of hard labor. There's a kind of determination on the part of the Egyptian older elite to put this genie back in the bottle and to stop these rounds of huge protests by the youth. And so they're trying to make object lessons of the youth leaders. But I would be very surprised if they succeed.
Can you characterize, I mean, overall, in terms of what happened with the Arab Spring, I mean, can it be characterized, and when you talk about the three achievements of essentially changing the cultural perspective of the Marnock Oblipsism, forgive me, the idea of a sort of a quasi-monarchy, presidency type of situation, or the sort of lack of accountability, and the notion of a more multicultural society, I mean, within limitations, I guess. But can you characterize what happened in the Arab Spring as being driven more as a almost some type of social emancipation or civil rights, again with an asterisk, movement, or was there also, how much of it was also about an economic struggle?
Well, economics were a very big part of it. I mean, the youth face very high rates of unemployment, and educated youth face higher rates of unemployment than less educated youth. And they felt that it was the Presidents for Life, the family cartels, the corruption that discouraged foreign investment in their countries, and that they believed that if they could change the political system so as to be more open and more accountable, that in turn would spur economic growth and provide them with jobs. A lot of these young people who are activists are from left-wing families, so they're the equivalent of Red Diver babies. They're themselves not oriented towards parties so much, but they are very sympathetic to the plight also of industrial workers and of village farmers who often now are lacking in water, in part because of government policy, in part because of climate change. And so they've used their bully pulpit of blogging and the internet and Facebook to mount campaigns on behalf of their less fortunate colleagues. And remember, many of the farmers and the factory workers are also in their 20s, and so there's a kind of generational solidarity there. So they were convinced that if they could change the political system, they could also affect the economic stagnation. And it is true that the Arab world is peculiar in the low degree of direct investment, and so they're not wrong about that, and I think in Tunisia things are working out over time so that they may well be proved right in their theory about this. And even in Egypt, the Gulf now has pledged very large amounts of money and investment in the aftermath of the overthrow of the Muslim Brotherhood government. So Saudi Arabia, UAE, Kuwait, which they were putting their money in Western banks and Spanish real estate and so forth, they've agreed really to put tens of billions of dollars into Egypt. So that economic dimension is certainly a big part of how these events have unfolded.
Fascinating. Well, and I guess we'll have a real sense of what the Arab, I guess the Arab summer, to the extent that it does come, maybe we're 10 years out or so. When these people, get a little bit older and begin to gain power.
Yes, I think if we think about it, if there were 25 when they made these revolutions, it's still 30 years before we see them in high government office. So many of their generational achievements are still way in the future, but they've changed the region and in some ways the world for the better, powerful ways. It's time to write them off.
Well, Professor Juan Cole, the book is The New Arabs, How the Millennial Generation is Changing the Middle East. We'll, of course, put a link up at majority.fm. Thanks so much for your time today.
It's been wonderful talking, Sam. Thanks so much.
Bye-bye. All right, folks. Well, phone crapped out right at the perfect time. And fascinating stuff. And I guess it will, I guess you guys will have to report on this in Majority Report, 2034, 2044. I hopefully will at that point be sipping mint juleps on the
you just killed southern about a coast year worth of Chardonnay jokes.
Southern buddy. Coast of the United States, which should be somewhere around like New Jersey, I think.
Right.
And
see you in Bergen County.
That's right. Where I'm overlooking the wonderful Gulf of, I think at that point we'll call it the Gulf of Delaware. As sea levels rise. And my children will have me in the protective orb that will have been developed at that time. And you guys can look back on this interview and see if the professor was correct. All right. Don't look so despondent, guys. Believe me, by that point, we're going to have a much nicer office. There's no doubt in my mind. With central air conditioning. Folks, it is your membership that will get us central air conditioning. We do hope, actually, to make a move, a lot of moves in the coming months. And so we will need your help, and your membership is what allows this show to grow. We're hoping to put out more content. We've got a whole list of things that we're developing of what we want to do over the, you know, leading into 2015, and it is your memberships that both allow us to keep doing this show, whether it's the free part or the members part, and as well as allowing us to grow. The reality is that things like terrestrial radio as a business model for talk radio is dying, if not extremely anemic. And shows like this will be the future. And so if you want us to be around in that future, a future that will be dominated by tech shows and wrestling shows, if Matt has any say in it, please support this program by becoming a member today. If you buy crap from Amazon, buy it through our link at majorityreportkickback.com. Go there, click on the Amazon link, bookmark it, buy all your crap through there. We get a kickback. That's why we call it majorityreportkickback.com. Also, justcoffee.coop, justcoffee.coop. Check it out. Fair trade coffee, co-op owned, coffee, tea, chocolate, organic if you want it. Use your coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. Buy the Majority Report blend. It's a great blend. Let's head to the funner half of the program. 646-257-3920. 646-257-3920 is the number. Of course, you can IM me. You can IM me through the app at majorityapp.com. Give us a review on iTunes. Tell someone to subscribe to our iTunes feed. Tell someone to get the app. Tell someone to buy the coffee. Tell someone to have a nice day. Yeah, why not? I'll throw one of those in a week or a month. All right, folks. See you in the fun app.